afternoon. So, last time, we started off by talking a bit about specific things that go on in the two-phase assignment. Then we looked at the question of security. And we started by mentioning that we have a bunch of things in our operating system that are features that implement what we call protection. They control access to things. And this is very related to what we usually think of as security, but in the case of security things, we have some sort of specific goal in mind as far as what policy we want to enforce about what's allowed using those protection mechanisms. And something we want to do when designing an operating system is to have support for a lot of policies that we can implement using whatever mechanisms we have available. And this meant we spent a lot of time talking about, how can we represent those sorts of policies? And we have this abstraction of what we call an access control matrix. We said, when we're running programs, we're going to assign the programs to what we call protection domains, which typically represent who the program's running on behalf of. And for each of those protection domains and each thing the program can access, a file, another program, anything that we have some decision about, are you allowed to do this? We're going to have a list of permitted operations. And this creates this big matrix of, where, say, the rows are each domain the program can belong to, and the columns are files or other objects that the program can access of what the permitted operations are. Now, as for actually storing this, usually we're not going to store this giant matrix. One option is we could store, protection domain object. Here are the operations that are allowed to store sort of a sparse version of this matrix. More commonly, we're going to store access control lists. And access control lists are that with each of the objects, we're going to store a list of who's allowed to access them. So we'll have our list of protection domains and the operations that are allowed. And we saw a concrete example of this with the sort of basic permissions that POSIX implements. And it's a very restricted version of this, where we could specify one user and what operations they were allowed to do, one group and what operations processes assigned to that group were allowed to do, and something for everyone else. And the operations we could specify were read, write, or execute. If we wanted more specific, too bad, not implemented in this policy. We also saw a more complete version where we had these more complete access control lists where we could have a list of as many users and groups as we wanted, and for each of them, again, we specified read, write, or execute. And we specified these users and groups with names, but we learned that the way that things are actually going to work are that inside the OS's implementation, it's just going to have, in the kernel, ID numbers for the users and groups. It's going to track those as processes are running and use those to implement these checks against these access control lists. And to actually enforce those checks, we're going to have in our system call implementation, we're going to, before we go on with the system call to open a file, kill a process, and so on, we're going to check these access control lists and say, are you allowed to do it? And if so, we'll proceed. If not, we'll just return error from our system call. We learned we needed to do those in the system call because it's very important that even an adversarially working program, someone being clever and writing the program, can't bypass these checks. And for system calls, that works because, the only way you can open a file is by making a system call. So as long as all the system calls that open files do that, you can't open one of these files if the access control list doesn't allow it. We also mentioned, we have some bootstrapping process. And one thing we need to worry about is when I'm logging in, how does that work? Especially since we learned that, the operating system doesn't actually know about passwords. It doesn't know about usernames. It only knows about these ID numbers. And the mechanism we saw was that we said that one user ID was special. And that was in POSIX user ID 0, we called this super user. And in all our permissions checks in those system calls, we had this special case where we said, if the user ID is 0, just allow it. And in particular, we had one thing that user ID 0 can do, which is that they can set their user ID to the current process to whatever they want. So we have someone's program that starts at boot, a login program that checks the username and password. How can it check the password? Well, it's stored somewhere that it, running with these extra permissions, can access, running as user ID 0. Once it checks that, it changes its user ID to whatever user we're supposed to run as and runs the shell. So that dealt with the special case of I'm logging into a machine. How do I have a program that lets me log in as anyone, but actually runs my shell as me and not, you know, something which can access everything? But then we had sort of the opposite problem, where we know that there's programs like sudo, where we can be logged into a system as a normal user running our processes with our user ID, which can't access everything, and we can get extra access to something. And with sudo, we type like sudo restart, it asks us for a password, and then it does this restart operation that we couldn't usually do. And we learned that the way that was implemented was with this idea of set user ID programs, that we would have programs which had an extra bit to mark that they were set user ID. And what this meant is that when we exec those programs, before we start the main function, the operating system is going to change the user ID to the owner of that program file, the user associated with that program file. And so sudo is set to be owned by user ID 0. So it gets to run as user ID 0, and it just has code which says, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to check the password, and if so, and the user is on the list of users that are allowed to do things, I'll let them do certain operations. It just has logic in it that allows specific things to be done in a controlled manner. So questions about things we covered last time? So mentioned that set user ID programs kind of, you know, there's a lot of uses for them, like mounting files. Like there's a way of mounting file systems, configuring file systems. We don't want to just let users configure any file system because they can mess up our existing ones. But we want them to like attach a removable device. We can make a set user ID program which does this without having to have the logic in the kernel to figure out, oh, is this file system you're configuring, is it one that isn't going to mess up like important stuff? Are you configuring it in the right way? That set user ID program can worry about that rather than us needing to modify the kernel to add these very complicated checks. And in general, sort of the set user ID program idea lets us do something kind of analogous to what system calls do. So we think of system calls as being a case where the hardware has decided some things are too dangerous to let normal programs do. They're only for the kernel. And the kernel says, well, I want to let programs do those things, but in a controlled way. Like, I want to let programs, you know, send stuff to the screen, but I don't just want to let them directly access the screen device, so I have a system call for that. And the system call gives controlled access to that functionality in a way which, you know, won't interfere with other things because we've designed it in a way which we trust the operations that are allowed. In the same way, the kernel has decided that certain things are only for root. Like root is the only one, super user is the only one who can set up new file systems or who can restart the machine. And we would decide, well, sometimes I want to let normal users do that. We can write out a set user ID program to allow them to do those operations in a manner we choose. Just like the kernel added system calls to allow programs to do things the hardware said the program shouldn't be able to do in a manner the kernel chose. This is where we left off last time. And I think I mentioned last time that the big topic today is that you should not write a set user ID program. So why shouldn't you do that? Well, it's almost certain to be broken. So let's give an example of trying to do this. So let's say I have a shared server and it has a directory of grades. And in that directory of grades, I have a folder for each assignment. In that folder for each assignment, I have a text file with the grades for every student. And I could use access control lists to give each student access to their own grades, but that's a lot of setting access control lists. So I decide that maybe an easier solution is I'm going to make a set user ID program that runs as a user that has access to all the grades. And users are going to run it with the assignment name. It's going to load that text file, print out its contents for them, rather than me needing to set all the access control list entries. So this is my motivation, and here's a program. And if I deploy this program, it's going to allow users to print out their grades. It's also going to allow a lot of other things, or potentially at least. So what is some examples of some things which can go wrong? I just mark this program as set user ID, let people run it. Yeah?
Might look up other students' grades.
So a question, it might look up other students' grades. So why would that be the case? So in this program, just to go over how this works, I into file name, I format this string all grades slash argv1 slash getenv user.txt. So that's the file view.
Couldn't you just use somebody else's student code or student ID or whatever the identifier is?
So couldn't we use someone else's student code? So the question is, what is user from? Do we know what user is from? Here, getenv user does. What does that do? So this is something about the current session. So the quick question is, what does this do? So this is get environment variable. And a good question is, where do these environment variables come from? How do I know that user has the right value? And the answer about where the environment variables come from is that every process has a bunch of key value pairs associated with them. And the current key value pair values are copied on exec, but we can change them in any process. So this value is just whatever was set when this program was exec. It could or could not be the real user. So the reason I write the program this way is that I think, well, normally when I'm running a program, the user environment variable is set by the shell or whatever runs the shell to the current user. But in fact, any program can set it to whatever they want by doing something like put env user equals something, and then executing another program. That program runs with a different user environment variable. So the problem here is that this user here is not actually retrieved based on the information the kernel tracks. So what we would want to do instead is we want to get the user ID from kernel and look up the name. That's what you want to do instead. The user ID, the kernel tracks, that's actually okay. But that user environment variable, that's just actually just a string that's there for convenience. It's not actually guaranteed to not be manipulated by whoever runs us. So that's one problem. Yeah. How about some other problems? There's more things that are wrong here. Including one I would hope people who took 3710 would catch. Yeah. There's a buffer overflow. So sprintf is storing the string in file name, which is 500 bytes long. And there's no reason that argv or 0 at 1 and the user environment variable are shorter than that. So that is a problem. We have a buffer overflow. And that could overwrite something important on the stack and cause this program to do execute code we don't expect. Anything else that might be wrong? Yeah. So we're opening a file for reading and writing. So indeed, that's suspicious. Well, how could that ever get be a problem? You only read, right? How would that become a problem? The possible other parts of the code could take advantage of it. This is the entire program, right? After main exits, the program goes away. So if something's going to happen to that file descriptor, it has to happen in this code. But there is an issue with that. But it's pretty subtle. So what we could do before calling this program is I could close standard out and then exec. And in that case, when I open a new file descriptor, the system is going to assign the lowest available number, which is going to be standard out. And that means that in that case, this printf would end up overwriting that file. Whether that would be a bad thing or not, it's a question of what's the file used for, but it certainly would corrupt the file. And this is another example of this is an example of something like the Getty and V issue, where the user can run this program in really strange ways. So I can run it without standard out being open. I can run it with the environment variables, which normally just tell me interesting things about, my current session, set to strange values, because there's nothing restricting that. So there's still another issue. It's a pretty big problem here. Yeah.
By modifying the RFD, you could be open a different path with the dot dot.
Okay, so you're saying, what if I run this with a path containing dot dot? Yes, so that is another issue we could have. So this argv0, what if it's dot dot slash dot dot slash dot dot slash instructor stuff slash secret, then I can access files in a directory I'm not supposed to. Because we didn't think that, this path doesn't have to just be an assignment name. I didn't check that. Anything else? Okay, so so there's all these issues that come up sort of in these set UID programs because of how much control whoever's running it has over environment variables. And, we mentioned some of them, like standard in, standard out, standard error could be closed. Environment variables can be set weirdly. Another example is that if I'm running a shell command, the path environment variable for my shell, which remember, in shells where you don't have to type, you can just type ls instead of bin ls, it has to figure out where ls is. How does it do that? Uses the path environment variable to know where the search. Well, that could be set into a malicious directory. We could run the program with argc being zero. So argv of one could be out of bounds. We can set configuration things for the dynamic linker and things like that, have the out of bounds issue. So there's just so many things which can go wrong. It is very, very difficult, unless you look up what people have done, to write a safe set user ID program. Just because there are things you are likely to miss. Let's talk about another issue that comes up commonly in these set user ID programs. And I'm going to give an example of a sort of motivation for a program. Let's say we have a program that is set user ID, which prints something. And why would it be set user ID? Well, we want to enforce that, you can only print 20 pages, not 1,000. So this program's going to do that by doing the printing for you, and we're not going to allow your programs to directly access the printer device, only this special program that the system administrator set up that's going to check that you're not printing too many pages. And this program is going to take from its command line a file to print. Makes sense. So can the printing program just call open? So if not, what I'm probably answering, so probably asking questions, or probably not. So what's the problem? Why can't we just call open of that file? What's the security issue? So our printing program is running on some special user. And when it calls open, the kernel is going to check, can that special user open this file? So if we're passing in a file to print and opening that, it's going to let you open files that you aren't supposed to be able to open and print them. So you can effectively use this as a very roundabout way of reading files you're not supposed to be able to read. So this program needs to enforce that when you specify a file to print, it's only a file that you're supposed to have access to. Otherwise, we're giving you ways of accessing files you're not supposed to have access to. And so if someone's confronted with this problem, often the first solution they'll think of is something like this, that we'll have some, we'll check, you know, look up the access control list and check, can the original user who ran this set user ID program access the file? Let's assume we look up the user in a way which is actually secure and do this check, and then we open it and print it, otherwise we, you know, don't. And this idea, the hope is that, you know, now the user can't print files that they're not allowed to read anyways. They can read them, printing them should be no problem. Problem is there's a race condition. Let's look at what the race condition is. So what an attacker can do here is an attacker can create a file that they're allowed to print. They can ask to print that file. And we're going to go to this check here. Can they print that file? Yeah, that's fine. And then in between when that check happens and when the set user ID printing program actually opens the file, we're going to delete the file and replace it with an alias for another file. So in this example, I'm using link. Link creates a hard link. So remember, hard links are just a directory entry pointing to a certain index, and we can have multiple of them. If my operating system doesn't support that, often there's other types of aliases. So for example, there's something called symlink, which is a symbolic link where we have a directory entry which, rather than storing an inode number, stores a path name, and we do look up the path name to find out where to go. Or other operating systems have other sorts of file aliases. So we're just setting up a file alias in a directory we control, and the file being aliased is a file we're not supposed to be able to read. And we're allowed to do that because we control the directory. And if I try to open that file using the alias, well, it's still not going to work for me because the kernel is going to check the permissions, the access control list for that file that's aliased. And it's going to say, no, you can't access secret, sorry. But the problem is, in this case, when the printing program checks, runs open, the kernel's going to say, oh, you're running a special user can access secret, that's fine. And the kernel doesn't realize that you checked previously that whether the user can access a different file with the same name, doesn't care. So questions about sort of how this scenario happens? So just the thing we needed is our file system allows us to have some sort of alias for another file that I can create in a directory I control. And that's actually a very common feature. Like, Unix likes generally have two versions of this, hard links, meaning you can just create another directory entry for existing file, and symbolic links, where you can create that alias with a name, where you just have the path in there stored in the directory. But this feature is very common. It's very useful to have sort of an alias shortcut, something like that, for an existing file. Questions?
So did they have to pause the setUID program?
Question, do they have to pause the setUID program? So there's two answers to that. So one answer is that we can try this a lot of times. So we can just hope that we get lucky enough, and maybe we help ourselves along by making the system busy, and we just keep trying to do this until we manage to run in between the check and the open. So that's one solution. And because we can just keep running the program, we can like try a million times. That is actually practical for an attacker to do. Another thing is that there are things we can do to make it slow, to make the open slow. So one example of this is that we can create what's called a symlink maze. So we can say, have the file system have lots of alias that it has to resolve to do the open. We can make resolving those especially slow by loading lots of things from disk that will remove cached copies of these directory entries from the cache and make the open call super slow. And by doing that, we can give ourselves a lot more time to run in between the permissions check and the open and make it much more likely that we can squeeze in. Another thing we can do, of course, is even if we don't have this sort of, you know, direct way of making the open, this particular open, like complicated for the OS to resolve. We can also do something like, you know, just access a bunch of stuff to make sure the disk doesn't have much cache to make things slower, so we have more time to squeeze in the middle, or something like that. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so it turns out that it seems like this is sort of a one in a million thing, but the reason that's not a problem is one, because it's okay for it to be one in a million, because we can try a million times, and two, because we can manipulate the state of the system to make the time window longer for us. And this is sort of happens in practice when people have these vulnerabilities. And I note that there's other sort of versions of this. Another common version is sometimes, rather than us specifying a file for a set user ID program to read, there will be a program that like creates a temporary file, and we create our own temporary file for it to write to, if it's not being careful. And that would be pretty bad if like it's the temporary file the password changing program uses, which is a real thing which has happened sometimes. And this general class of problems is called a time to check to time of use vulnerability, because we have one time where we're checking whether things are allowed, one time where we're actually using the thing we checked, and these are different times and things can change. And this sort of pattern is a very common bug when people are dealing with sort of access control checks. So there's a good solution to this, and that's that our set user ID program can temporarily become the original user, do the open, and then switch back to the special user. And to support this, POSIX has multiple user IDs. So I mentioned when I talked about getting the user ID, we had get EUID. The reason for effective user ID, you might say, well, why was it effective? Well, because we have these other user IDs for the purpose of having set user ID programs temporarily switch back to the original user. So that's supported, just so we can run the open with the effective user ID of the original user, not our special user. And that open will check the permissions correctly. And why don't we have a time to check to time of use problem there? Well, because the operating system, when it implements open, it's going to look up what the file is, then check the permissions on it, and open the file it just looked up. It's not going to look up the file twice. It's always going to open that file it just checked the permissions on. We don't have any sort of difference between what we're checking and what we're opening. Some questions? Just fix. Okay. So I mentioned sort of the canonical fix. The best fix is that we have some way of actually doing the open as the with the correct user ID, not with our special user ID. Often people come up with other fixes, some of which may or may not work. And I'm asking which of these other fixes would be secure. So our first option is, rather than just checking before we open, let's also check after we open that the user is allowed to access it. Another option is, after we open, let's make a system call to check the access control list on the file we opened using that file descriptor we got and see if the user would be allowed to access it. And C is, rather than just checking that the user is allowed to read the file, make sure the user is allowed to read the file and controls the directory the file's in. Who would like some more time? Okay, so let's start with A. Who thinks A would be secure? Thinks A would be insecure? Okay, so we have a split. And I would say that this is a common thing people do try to do in this case, and it doesn't fix the problem. And it's not obvious why it doesn't fix the problem. And basically, the reason why is that what I can do to get around this is that in the solution, we'd have a check here, right? And in between that check, I can do the same thing I did originally. I can unlink and link back something that's OK. Now, so this makes it harder for me as an attacker, but I can still do the same attack. I just need to replace the file and then place it again. But it's just doing that what I was doing before twice. So no, so the attacker sort of replaces the alias before and after open. So the attacker just does the replacement before and after, just so when we do the checks, it's okay, but not when we're actually doing the open. So yes, it's harder for the attacker, but it doesn't actually solve our problem. And if the attacker found a reliable way of getting the timing to work for the original case, they can probably reliably enough get the timing to work for this new case. How about B? Who thinks B is secure? Okay, B is not secure. Okay, so B is okay. Now, provided that opening the file won't have any side effects, it should be fine because we know that we're checking the permissions on the same file we actually have opened. It'd be preferable to do the open the file as the right user option, but at least here, we know that we're actually checking the permissions on the right file because it's the one we have opened, therefore it's the same one we're going to read. Some questions about that? People look confused. Okay. So let's see. How about C? Who thinks C would be secure? Would be insecure? Okay, so most people say it would be insecure, and that's right. Because this is exactly the scenario we had in the original attack, is that I controlled the directory it was in because I needed that control to create the aliases. So it doesn't actually tell me whether I control the files that might be aliases that are in that directory. Links of some various sorts. So questions on these options? And I'm mentioning these because sort of A is really a very common thing people try to do to fix this problem, which still doesn't work. So you should make sure you avoid it. You know, if you really can't do sort of our preferred option of sort of temporarily switching who you're opening as, you should try something that's more like B, where you like somehow get a handle on the right file directly and then check that. But probably you should have a way of figuring out who opening as the right user, so the kernel just does all the checks for you correct the way you want them to be done. Okay, so we have a whole bunch of sort of mechanisms we talked about. Let's talk about, just sort of as an example, let's say I wanted to allow students to make ad hoc groups and collaborate on a shared server. What sort of security things do I want to enforce for that? Someone give me something we should allow or disallow for that. Sort of what properties should hold? Yeah. Okay, so students within a group should be able to access each other's files. Each other's files should have a way of doing that. Okay. Other things we want. What shouldn't we allow?
Yeah. Can't view a different group's files.
Okay. Can't access another group's files. Anything else? So these seem like properties. So how can we implement this policy using the mechanisms we've discussed? Give me a proposal.
Use the POSIX feature to create like a group and then set students to belong to the same groups that are within
the group. So create a group ID for each student group. Student group and configure these login programs so students are assigned to student programs are assigned run as that group. So students log in and run programs in that group. Programs with that group ID. Okay, so that is a way we could do it. And so that handles like having groups. What do we do with those groups? Just then use the group ID U plus read write in the ACLs of the files. So when you set that group ID in the file, ACLs, so we can access each other's files. So that would be sort of the standard POSIX mechanism for it. Sort of another option is we could not create groups, or two, so that would be one. Two is we could create an ACL listing all the students in a group in each group in a group and assign that and imply that ACL to each of that group's files, each file. So we could write our ACL with just listing each user individually and apply that, have some way where you apply that to all the files that a particular student in that group is dealing with. Those would be sort of our two logical mechanisms. Questions on that? And I mentioned the second one because often it's actually, it would make sense to make new groups, but often that's like, that involves the system administrator, and this other solution would not involve the system administrator because we don't have to like reconfigure the login program and assign a new ID number. So questions? Okay, so we've talked about the most common approach we see, especially on desktop systems, for managing what processes can access. And generally, everything is based on these user IDs and group IDs that are assigned to a process. And the user ID and group ID is not something we, writing the process, actually deal with most of the time. They're kind of information that's on the side that we don't usually see. And a name for this might be ambient authority. So kind of in the air when we're running our program is what user ID and group ID we have, what we're allowed to access. And there's an alternate style of approach where instead of having this sort of information on the side that says what things you can access, we want to tie it tightly with your ability to address things. So we'll have some way of addressing items. And if you have an address for something, you can access it. If you don't, you can't. And this notion is called capabilities. So the idea is if you have a token that identifies a thing for accessing it, it gives you permission to access it. And the big argument people have for capabilities, maybe not the only one, but one of the big ones is that it kind of simplifies what we're doing in the kernel to enforce these restrictions. So in the kernel, what we're going to say is, here's a token, what object is it? And that process checks if you have permission to access the object. That just looking up what this token means is going to check if you have permission to access it, versus our access control list based scheme where we're like, we take a path, we look up what that path is, and we have a completely separate process of figuring out, are you allowed to access that path? And this is arguably simpler, and that means hopefully, you know, harder to mess up the implementation of it. And you might say, well, this scheme sounds a little weird because, you know, I'm used to, like, being able to name a file and separate from whether I can name the file is whether I can access it. So what would this look like? And we actually already have capabilities on our system. They're just not used for everything. So for example, file descriptors kind of work in this way. Each process has a list of open files it can access, and we have a token to access each file. That token is the index in that list. And the operating system knows you can access a file if you have it open. So the write system call, for example, on XV6, it looks up that open file, and based on that lookup, it determines, yes, this is a file descriptor you can write to. It doesn't do a separate access control list check on the write. It just does a lookup of the file descriptor, and that does the access control list for open file, check for open files. This already, it does the, not the access control list check, but just the access control check for open files. Can you access it? Do you have it open and marked as a writable file descriptor? If so, yes. And we can also think of sort of page tables as working the same way. If you want to access a physical page of memory, you need an address for that page. The address you get is a virtual address. It only works if the processor can look it up in a page table. If you don't have a page table entry for a physical page, you have no way of accessing it. We don't need to check when you access some part of memory, you know, are you allowed to access it? Instead, we do our lookup of, is this something, is what physical address is it? And part of that lookup gives us, can you access it or not? You know, whether that lookup works or not, that tells us if you can access it or not. It's not sort of an independent check of these are the pages you have permission to access. And sort of the general pattern we see with this is that in this capability design, we kind of have a list of what a process can access that's stored with the process. And that's our access control mechanism. Rather than having sort of a user and group ID that we check against something other information, we just directly store the list of what you can access. And your handle to access the access something is basically just a key in a table of the list of things you can access. And this means that sort of our permissions check is very natural. So questions about this sort of basic capability idea? Okay. So one thing that does seem like an issue with this design is that previously, if I wanted to let another, if I, you know, wrote a file and wanted to let another program access it, I had a file name, and there was a separate check for could the program access it. What we'd like instead is like some way of sharing things that we've created when we don't have some sort of name with a global permission check. We want to just give them the token to access it. And commonly, capability schemes will have some way of transferring your access token to another program. And we actually see this with our file descriptor capabilities. So with file descriptors, you can, if you fork, your fork program has all the same file descriptors. It has those tokens. They're copied. Also, Unix systems commonly support ways where we can open a file, and rather than telling another process, hey, why don't you open this file with the same name, we can just give them a copy of our file descriptor. And how does that work? Well, there's a special sort of version of the write call for a local socket where the operating system will copy the file descriptor from your file descriptor array to the receiving process's file descriptor array. And this is very commonly implemented on Unix-likes, even though it's not part of POSIX. It's slightly different on each Unix-like OS. But it's a common feature because it's not too hard to implement. It's sort of a nice, elegant way of sharing the file permission, you know, because we've already done the can you access it, so you can let someone else access it. That shouldn't be a problem. Now, it's hard to think of what is a system that's based on capabilities look like with the sort of POSIX design, because POSIX has a lot of things which really don't make sense if we don't have something like access control lists. So as a concrete example, I'm going to talk about sort of a research paper called Capsaicin, which was some people in Cambridge took FreeBSD, a Unix-like OS, and tried to make it more capabilities-based, that they still wanted to support original Unix programs, so they kind of had this be an opt-in thing, where you could set a process to only use capabilities to access objects and no sort of global names that would require access control list checks. So that means what things would require sort of those checks? Well, absolute paths. If I go /home/my username, you know, the operating system knows I can access that only because of access control list. We can't just let any program have access to that. If I use a process ID to kill a process, I can't just let any program do that, kill any process by ID. I have to have some way of knowing access it. So what they said is, well, we're going to need some way of representing your ability to access directories, to manipulate processes and like kill them. And they decided that we're just going to extend file descriptors to do that, because file descriptors look like capabilities, they just don't refer to enough things. So they made new types of file descriptors that could refer to directories or processes. And they also made the file descriptor support permissions other than read or write. So right now, when we open a file descriptor, it remembers it wasn't open for reading or writing. They also said you could open file descriptors for executing something, for opening files in a directory, for a directory file descriptor, for killing if it's a process file descriptor, and so on. So they just added these extra things that a file descriptor would be opened for. And this meant that sort of in their design, you know, we wouldn't have any global names. So if you wanted to open a file in a directory, you'd have to have a capability for the containing directory. And then you'd use this open at call, where you'd specify, here's the directory I want to start in. I have a file descriptor for that. That's not why you know I can access it. Here's something inside it I want to get another file descriptor for. If you wanted to execute a file, you could have the executable opened for execute, and then you could use this file execute system call instead of executing with a path. If you wanted a fork, rather than getting a PID that you kill and the operating system having to figure out, oh, that's one of the PIDs you're allowed to have access to, you get a, you call this process descriptor fork function, and it gives you a file descriptor which you pass to a different version of kill. And you can pass that file descriptor around. If you have that file descriptor, you can kill the process. If you don't, you can't. Rather than needing to know the rather than being able to kill it if you know the process ID and your user ID matches. So this is the sort of design that capability-based system would have. And you might say, gosh, well, this seems like something like that we could use in a, you know, specialized context, but how would we implement sort of normal features of our system? Like, how would I live with a system where I don't have any access control list? And something worth noting is that we could have our kernel use this capability-based design and have programs that support access control lists on top of that. So for example, we could have a server that we send a path name to, and it checks who you are and then sends back a file descriptor for that path if you're allowed to access it or not if you're not. And in this way, we could have the kernel not know anything about access control lists, but still implement them somewhere in our system. But the kernel is based on this simpler capability-based design, which means the system calls, you don't need to actually do access control checks. That can all be done somewhere else. And that's one way that some operating systems that are based on this design can work if they don't want to have, you know, everything, you know, not have files and directories with permissions in the traditional sense. They can still implement that sort of on top of it. So questions about capabilities? Okay, so just mentioning that, yeah, so as I said, Unix doesn't do it, but there are real OSs which are sort of use this design at the kernel level especially, because it is a nice sort of simple way that makes the kernel interface a lot simpler, and you can kind of bootstrap most of the functionality that we have in the more traditional access control sense if you need it. Okay, so in our last 20-ish minutes, talk a bit about virtual machines. We're going to just go over basically the simplest way to implement virtual machines. So if you remember, at the beginning of the semester, we talked about this notion of a virtual machine that, you know, when we run a program, it thinks it's running on a, something that looks like a machine but has some special features. We call that a virtual machine. And we said that, like, for most of the semester, we would talk about process virtual machines, this convenient interface with system calls that's really designed for us to write programs. But we mentioned, oh, there's also these system virtual machines, which are trying to imitate physical hardware, where we're trying to run an OS that's designed to run on physical hardware, not on physical hardware. And, you know, we're going to choose some hardware to imitate. Usually, it's going to be whatever's easiest to emulate. Talk about how that works. First, some terminology things. So, when we talking about having virtual machines, system virtual machines, where we have the virtual machine implementation, which I'm going to call a hypervisor or a virtual machine monitor. And the hypervisor or virtual machine monitor is going to be tied to what we'll call a host OS. It could be the host OS itself, but it has to be tightly integrated for at least some functionality into the host OS, which is the operating system that runs the hypervisor or is somehow tied to the hypervisor so the hypervisor can get code to run when our guest OS, the thing we're running in the hypervisor, runs. We're going to use the term guest OS for the thing, operating system, that's sort of running at, like an application would on a real OS, but in the hypervisor. So our hypervisor is going to let the guest OS run. It's going to give it this virtual interface that looks exactly like some physical hardware. And, well, actually, that varies. So we could implement something which looks exactly like physical hardware. And this would mean that we take a guest OS that runs on physical hardware, we run it in this virtual machine, and we wouldn't change anything. This is called full virtualization. And it's not actually that common. There's also paravirtualization, where we decide that we're okay with changing the guest OS a bit to running a virtual machine. And usually we're going to make very small changes. So for example, a very common change to make is to change how page table entries are set. It turns out implementing page tables for a virtual machine is complicated and high overhead. But we can relatively easily just take our OS and find all the places where it sets page table entries and make that, like, do the equivalent of a system call and make it easier for the hypervisor to implement those page tables. So functionality like that will make these little changes to the guest OS to support the virtual machine monitor, the hypervisor implementation, to make the hypervisor implementation simpler and more efficient. And I'm going to use these terms, full virtualization and paravirtualization. In practice, there's kind of a fuzzy line. So for example, a common thing we'll do is we'll have a guest OS that's not modified, but we'll have some special device driver that doesn't work on any real hardware. Like, we'll have a display driver where the display device it talks to doesn't look like any real display device would, but works in the virtual machine monitor. Some people still think that's full virtualization. Some people don't. And I don't really care. Just want to know, you know, that there's sort of some ambiguity there. So we talked about sort of the interface that would be provided, and there's actually multiple ways of implementing it. And I'm going to talk about one way of doing it. And there's some variations I'm going to mention, but which aren't, you know, something I'm going to go into detail. So one thing is that we're going to see when we go over sort of a very, very brief introduction to how you might implement a virtual machine that there's some stuff we're doing which is pretty complicated where maybe the hardware could help us out. And on sort of modern machines, very commonly there's some hardware support to make things simpler, where the hardware will implement some common virtual machine monitor tasks in a way that's helpful. Another option, besides the one we'll talk about, is that rather than doing something where we're going to run the guest OS code directly on the processor, that's going to be our solution, we can take the guest OS code and compile it to new machine code. This is, in fact, how QEMU works. QEMU compiles the guest OS code to other machine code and runs that other machine code. this sounds incredibly complicated and slow. It's not as slow as you might think, but it is complicated. And it is a real technique used to implement virtual machines, including sort of some production, like commercially sold virtual machines. But it's not the technique we're going to talk about. The technique we're going to talk about, we're going to run the guest OS directly on the hardware. So just like we do with normal programs, when I execute a program on my normal OS, that program ends up running directly on the processor. Its registers are the processor registers. We're going to do the same thing with the guest OS. So conceptually, we're going to have our guest OS running directly on the processor, and just like a normal process, it's going to run in user mode. But the whole thing is going to run in user mode. So even when the guest OS is in the guest OS's kernel, it's going to be running in user mode. And our hypervisor code, or at least part of it, is going to run in kernel mode. And the hypervisor is going to track whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode or not. So we're going to have a pretend kernel mode and a pretend user mode, both of which are really user mode on the underlying hardware, but this is sort of in our virtual machine, is it kernel mode or user mode? We're going to track that in our hypervisor implementation. And we're going to track for the guest OS we're running, we're going to track all the sorts of things we tracked for normal processes. So we're going to track all the guest OS register values, just like for a normal process, I track the register values when I switch away from it. We're going to track what memory it can access. We're going to track what I/O devices it can access. That is what files it had to open. These are all just tracking the same sorts of things we tracked for normal processes on a normal non-virtual machine monitor OS. But we're also going to track information about what the guest OS thinks it's doing in kernel mode. So for example, we're going to track, does the guest OS think it's in kernel mode now or not? We're going to have to track that information, taking the place of the hardware, which would previously have tracked that. The guest OS is going to like set an exception table pointer to figure out how its exceptions are handled. We're going to have to track what that is, because we aren't going to set the real exception table pointer. We're going to be implementing that functionality ourselves in the hypervisor instead of having the hardware do it. And we're also going to have to track some, have some other information set up for the CPU. So the guest OS is going to kind of run like a process, but we're going to have to track all the information about the state of the guest OS that normally the hardware would track. So we're going to have to track if exceptions are disabled or not, where the exception table is, where the page table-based register is. We're going to track all that stuff that normally would be tracked by the hardware because we're imitating that hardware. That's part of imitating it. So it's just a whole bunch of extra stuff in our equivalent of the process control block. So questions so far? Okay, so this gets to what information we're tracking, but then there's a question of like, how do we do things that the hardware would previously do? And our hope is going to be that when the guest OS tries to do things, it's going to trigger an exception. So for example, if the guest OS tries to read from the keyboard, that's not going to work because it's running in user mode. So that's going to trigger an exception. If it tries to disable interrupts, that's going to trigger an exception. You're not allowed to do that in user mode. If it tries to make a system call, that's going to trigger an exception because it's a system call. And what the hypervisor is going to do is it's going to do what the processor would normally do in that case. And I'm going to go through the example of how that's going to look for dealing with I/O as sort of a simple example. So let's say we're accessing a device. So the guest OS running in user mode tries to access the device. This triggers a protection fault in the hardware. The hardware runs the protection fault handler, which is going to be code that the hypervisor controls. And the hypervisor is going to say, oh, the guest OS was trying to talk to a device. Let me do that on its behalf and send the result back. So what that might sort of look like is we'll have in our hypervisor our exception handler. And our exception handler is going to say, oh, was this exception caused because the guest OS was trying to read from the keyboard? If so, Well, I'm going to read from the keyboard for it. Now, maybe the way my hypervisor works, it doesn't actually get input from the keyboard. It gets it from like a network connection. That's OK. I'm going to do some operation that implements that read. So let's think of how this would work for reading from the keyboard in XV6. So if you remember, in XV6, the way we read from the keyboard is we did this special instruction that would read from a special IO address. So this was, our code was called this in function, which translates to this in instruction, which works, which takes two registers as its arguments. It reads from the IO address in the first argument into the register in the second argument. So that's the in instruction. And when the guest OS runs this instruction, it's going to trigger an exception because, well, you aren't allowed to do the in operation in user mode. So that triggers an exception. And in our hypervisor, we'd say, OK, well, there was an exception, and it was a protection fault. It tried to run a type of instruction it wasn't allowed to run. And the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode. So I'll emphasize thinks it is. The guest OS, of course, really runs in user mode on the physical hardware, but the guest OS, as far as it's concerned, is in kernel mode. So it should have been allowed in the machine we're imitating. The machine, you know, if the guest OS was running on real hardware, this would have worked. So we're going to make it work. So in this implementation, what I proposed is that I look up the address that triggered the exception. I read the instruction there to see if it's an in instruction. And if so, I determine what IO address it was reading from. I look up that IO address and determine, oh, that's part of the keyboard device controller, and it's for the keyboard read. So let's do the actual read. And then we have to imitate the rest of what that instruction did. What does that instruction do? Well, it copies from the device controller into a register. So I need to update the registers based on what was just read. And also, it goes to the next instruction. So I need to increment the program counter based on the size of the instruction. So this approach is known as trap and emulate. So we have a trap happen when the guest OS tries to do something that it can't actually do directly on the hardware, and we emulate what the hardware would do. And you might say, gosh, we're spending a lot of effort here because I have these functions, I haven't shown the implementation to, where I have to parse machine code to implement this. Isn't this not very efficient? Yeah, it's not great, but it works. So this is our simplest way of implementing a virtual machine. So note that we didn't need any special hardware support here. All the hardware did for us is it told us the guest OS tried to do something only OSs are supposed to do. And we implemented that functionality for it because it wasn't really running as an OS. So questions? Approach here. OK. So I showed sort of what happened in the case where, you know, the guest OS thought it was running in kernel mode, so we actually did the operation that would have happened on the hardware. We might have done it slightly differently, like the guest OS may have thought it was reading from a keyboard, maybe we read from like an SSH connection, but we did it on its behalf. There's another case. Let's say we had this happen and the guest OS thought it was running in user mode. So not only was it really running in user mode, but if we look at what the guest OS thought it did, thought it switched back to user mode and ended up running this instruction. Well, in that case, the guest OS should handle this exception instead of us. So what we're going to do in that case is we're just going to take this protection fault that happened and reflect it back to the guest OS, because that's what the hardware would do. If the guest OS was running a program and the program ran some crazy instruction, it would just ask the guest OS what to do. So we, as the hypervisor, we need to do the same thing. When the guest OS was running a program, we detect, oh, the guest OS wasn't running in kernel mode, it was running a program. We need to ask the guest OS in kernel mode what to do. So we'll have code where we'll say, you know, if the guest OS is in user mode, in that case, you know, put the guest OS in kernel mode. Remember, we're tracking whether the guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode. So we'll say, yes, it does. And run as exception handlers by switching to the right address to do that. Questions? Yes. And sort of, I should note that, you know, so I showed this as the process of how we deal with what if the guest OS is running a program that like accesses some crazy thing. So this won't happen very often. But what will happen is, let's say the guest OS runs a program that makes a system call. Well, the system call is going to be a system call that gets handled by the hypervisor, because the hypervisor has the exception handlers. That exception handler needs to know to make it an exception, pretend it's an exception in the guest OS. So that's how our hypervisor is going to implement a system call. It's that the same process that we're going to say, oh, there was an exception. We're going to switch to the guest OS in kernel mode ourselves, because the hardware won't do that for us. So there's a bunch of other, so this is where we're syncing with the other lecture. We finished off. I don't think we have time to like go into much more detail about sort of virtual machine implementation things. The one big topic we're kind of glossed over is how we manage page tables, which is probably the most complicated part of implementing virtual machines in this sort of way. So we're just not going to get to that this semester. The basics of it. So questions about virtual machines? Or... Okay, so as it says on the schedule, on next Tuesday is exam review. The way that's going to work is I'm going to take questions about things you want me to talk about. If you don't have questions, there will be a very short class. So that's all I have for today. So see you during the exam review. And Two Faces due next week, and that's it, I think.